This week on Writers, Inc.
That first chapter is the most important. The most important line, two lines you're going to write in the book are the first and last. Because the first line will decide if anybody reads the second. And the last line will decide if anybody's going to read you again. Because you've taken on that long journey. You know, and then you let them down with one bound, he was free. So you've got to knock the first line is so important, and then the first paragraph. And by the end of the first page, your reader's got to be hooked.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
Kevin Tumlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So we always talk before the show starts. Kevin started rambling about something, and I'm like, I need to record this because you all need to hear it. So
I like how it's always Kevin's rambling.
Well, that's the thing, because Kevin rambles. He does. And, you know, like, but occasionally there's some gold there. And, like, I have never heard this before. So, like, you need to explain what just happened to your Southwest points, because yeah. I didn't know that this could even happen.
Well, okay. It all started last Friday. I got an email and saying verifying that my whatever trip had been booked and it cost 15,000 points on my Southwest Rapid Rewards account. And I sent it to my wife and said, "Hey, was this you?" Because we're starting to book flights for some of the conferences, and she said no. And I meant to check in on it, but I got sidetracked. And the next day I got three more emails, for like 20 something thousand points each. And I finally went and checked, and like somebody had hacked my, Southwest Rapid Rewards account and stole like 80,000 points from me. So I'm down to like 2,000 now.
Wow.
So, yeah. So they're investigating it, but you know, they're like, "Oh, it could take up to 30 days.
Will they give them back? You know, like, and just kind of credit them back to your account?"
Well, I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they don't give you any answers. You know, they kind of treat it like I'm scamming them. And, and I've been really nice about it. You know, I don't want to go full Karen on anything. Sorry to any Karens in the audience, but you know, I made a point of saying, look, I was literally about to use these points to book some flights. So I'd like to get them back. It's, you know, saves me quite a bit of money. What was really the kicker today, I called them again today because this morning I get this email and it's a survey from their support team wanting to know how they did with my issue. And I'm like, well, and I check, cause I'm like, oh, maybe they get my points back, and they're still gone. But yeah. And what's killing me is it tells me, it has a little record of how many points were used and what they were used for. And again, so it says one of them was a flight from Atlanta to New York. Three of them were for flights from Chicago to Houston. But they don't tell me who booked them or when the flights are or any information I could use to actually track down who did it. So
can you cancel the flights?
Well, they don't show up as flights for me. All I see is the rewards. And, you know, of course they ask, you know, who did you share your account with? Man, nobody. And, you know, there was a lot of back and forth on like how this is probably my fault.
So. It's less high stakes, but my friend had that happen with her Domino's pizza account. They took her free pizzas that she had been building up. Domino's gave her pizzas back, but
that might be worse.
I guess that's what people do now. They go for the rewards.
Well, you know, there is a dollar value to these rewards too.
I
mean, and it comes, you know. It represents about $80,000 of actual money. And so I want to know who it is because I want to press charges. But they're real funny. Isn't it funny? Like, they're like, oh, how, we have to respect the privacy of the thief. You know, we can't allow them to be.
I have never had points happen, but I did have someone go to Korea on my credit card. And I was like, that was not me. So, but I mean, they're better about that because I'm just like, hi, I didn't go to Korea. And they're like, oh, okay. But yeah, I've never had points stolen.
Yeah, credit cards are pretty good at that. I think rewards is kind of a new frontier, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I use Amex to pay for everything business related, and I rack up a ton of points because I put literally everything I can. I bought a car on my Amex before, so I will put everything on there. And my wife she uses the points for our vacations. I never really paid too close attention to how that all works. Like, she logs into the Amex account, she books the flights, she books the rental car and the hotel and that kind of thing. And then I just assumed that the points would be deducted right out of my account and like go away and just pay for those items. But it doesn't actually work that way on Amex. Like, so when I go to pay my bill, I've actually been paying off her travel expenses with cash. And like, the points don't actually get used. So my points just keep going up and up and up and up and up. And like, I couldn't figure out, like, I knew I was racking up a lot of points, but I couldn't figure out why the balance wasn't going down. And it turns out, cause I was just paying it incorrectly. That whole points thing, it seems very scammy. Like the whole thing, like even when you're on a plane, you know, like they try to, you know, force you to sign up for their credit card before you land. And, which I'm sure is how you got the Southwest one. You know, at least Southwest is creative with it.
Yeah. My favorite part is when you're about to land and they shut everything off and use that time as like, you know, forced. You have to listen to their ad about getting their credit card and all that stuff. So you're not allowed to even think.
It's an infomercial you can't turn off.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mine is we have a financial institution here, which also is linked with a grocery store somehow. So mine are all grocery points. I get free groceries all the time, and there's nothing better than paying nothing for your groceries.
I will tell you, I use the Amazon Prime card and I get points there.
Yeah.
And one thing that I've used that for a lot is when I needed books for, you know, like if I was going to do a signing or something like that and I needed them fast, I would buy them using the Amazon Prime card and I'd have points. So I'd use the points to get as much knocked off as possible. Sometimes I'd get a whole bunch for free and then I get, you know, it counts towards sales and I save the money and I get more points and I end up getting royalties on the books. So little pro tip there.
Cool.
Costco has a good, if you use the Costco has a credit card and, they build up. It's a little bit different because they give you a certificate every year. So it's not like you can just like use them, but it usually equates to a nice little check they send you every year. So that's nice. Thank you, Costco.
All right. Well, hopefully you will get your points back. What's going on in the news?
Well, first up, Random House Publishing Group to acquire Boom Studios. Random House Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, has agreed to acquire Boom Studios, a comic book, graphic novel, and licensed storytelling publisher and studio. Boom Studios will remain in its LA office and continue distribution through Diamond Comic Distributors and Simon & Schuster. Founded in 2005, Boom Studios publishes under four distinct lines and is known for best-selling works like Berserker, Something is Killing the Children, and Lumberjanes. Big fan, along with licensed titles such as Power Rangers and Dune. I've heard of one of those. Guess which one? So Boom Studios has also produced films and TV series, including Two Guns and The Empty Man. It is currently working on Butterfly, a live-action series for Prime Video. I love comics, but I don't know any of these comics. That makes me kind of sad.
Oh, Berserker is the one that Keanu Reeves does. Berserker. And Lumberjanes is big with the kids. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So what I find interesting is, so they're acquiring Boom, but they're still going to continue through Simon & Schuster.
Yeah.
Thoughts from people smarter than me on why
that is. I was trying to figure that one out, too. I mean, I'm guessing they just don't want to unravel the machine, or they might have, you know, like everything is already set up, but like it kind of doesn't make sense. Who knows? I would like to know a little bit more about that. I'm not a big comic guy, so I you know, I don't think I've ever actually been into comics. I've tried to get into comics. Like I bought them when I was a kid. I was like, my friends are reading these. I should be reading these. But I never really got into the stories. I've even got a collector's editions of, I think it's Tales from the Crypt, whatever that, something like that. I've got a whole bunch of those, that I've never actually opened. I just bought them because they were collector's editions. Maybe I need to check out comics.
I had a hard time too, but all my friends like them. And I was like, I don't like superheroes, blah, blah, blah. That's boring. But my friend gave me a copy of Chew. Thank you, Jay. Which is the most disturbing and macabre comic I have ever read. And I loved every minute about it. It's about a detective who can get flashes of things by tasting things. So he takes like bites of corpses and stuff. And I was like, this is right up my alley. This is fantastic. It was hilarious and nauseating and horrifying all at the same time. So I started to like graphics a little bit more after that. I've heard From Hell is a masterwork, but I haven't read it. It's very big.
Yeah.
But that's on my list.
So. That was the Johnny Depp movie based on that? Is it Jack the Ripper?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was. See, I knew something. and I was always the quintessential, like I was a Marvel fanboy, so that, you know, I was that typical nerd. I credit comics with teaching me to write, so that was my big thing. I definitely learned how to handle dialogue, and you know, I learned pacing and things like that from comics. But for what that's worth, all right, next up, contracts and book publishing. WIPO launches. I don't know if I'm supposed to pronounce that. Is it WIPO, WIPO? I don't know. WIPO launches a toolkit for authors and publishers. Contracts and Publishing, a toolkit for authors and publishers, provides detailed information on copyright and contractual options in the book sector, aiming to foster understanding between writers and publishers. Developed by the World Intellectual Property Organization, we'll say WIPO, since 2021, the toolkit is designed to assist writers, translators, visual artists, and publishers, particularly in developing countries, by offering comprehensive guidance in negotiating and concluding contracts. The toolkit covers essential topics such as the publishing value chain, licensing, responsibilities of authors and publishers, and various contractual clauses, offering non-binding advice and useful resources for publishing and licensing agreements. I kind of want this. Where do I sign up?
Yeah, there's a link right there. Go click it.
I'll get to it later.
Have you guys ever used this kind of resource before? I know a lot of the writers' organizations all have, you know, like a section like on their website, or they've got people you can work with related to it. I've never actually relied on one of those before.
No, but it looks like something I should know more about.
That's what I'm starting to feel. Is I should have long ago started looking at something like this. Now I have a link, apparently.
I'm kind of one of those guys that I'm partially lazy, but I also feel like I've got a lawyer that, you know, already represents me, and like I defer to him for this sort of thing. Like I don't want to play, you know, armchair lawyer when it comes to my contracts. I mean, it's definitely good. I mean, you don't want to sign anything, obviously, without understanding it fully. If you don't have somebody that can explain it to you, I guess this is another viable option.
I will say that this is the same, that you should apply the same philosophy as I did when I was working in like film and TV. Like I came up doing all the various jobs, you know, and operating camera, setting up lights, all that. And when I became a producer, It wasn't about like, I need to know this so that I can go do it. It was about knowing it so that I knew what to expect and what to ask for and what these people should be paid, things like that. And I think it's the same sort of thing here. Like you should know this stuff, not so that you can take over and do it from your attorney, but so that you know, because how many times have you found out that, you know, somebody made a mistake or somebody was scamming or something, you know, there's always some reason to kind of double check. It's good to know how things should work.
Yeah.
All right. Final story. TikTok's developing a new AI chatbot called Genie. TikTok is preparing to launch its AI chatbot Genie to Western users, allowing them to pose questions and get immediate responses. TikTok's current AI chatbot, Taka, available in the Philippines, helps guide users to other videos. The next generation Genie chatbot will integrate all TikTok's AI elements, including generative AI search, enabling users to maximize discovery within and outside the app. The AI search feature in Duven, TikTok's Chinese version, allows users to obtain answers generated by intelligent search technology. This expanded search capability will be part of the new chatbot, enhancing user interaction and discovery. TikTok plans to incorporate functionalities like the stream voice system, AI music generation, and text-to-video creation into the Genie chatbot.
All very cool stuff going into TikTok, and TikTok, as far as I know, is still going away on January 19th.
Yeah. Is anyone planning to use this for their author stuff?
No, I mean, I love a lot of the stuff that TikTok does, but you know, having that date hanging over their head, and you know, like the stories that I'm hearing is they're not willing to divest, which means, you know, a U.S. company is not going to be able to buy them, and the app itself is going to go away. And like every time I think about that, like it, you know, it seems almost pointless to double down on advertising on that platform, building anything on that platform. You know,
yeah.
Why bother? And what you're seeing on the flip side is Instagram and these other services, they're implementing things to basically mimic what TikTok is doing now, getting ready for the rush of people, you know, looking for another venue. So if I'm going to double down anywhere, it's going to be on, you know, probably Instagram or one of these other, you know, something that's Instagram. Not going anywhere, at least not today.
Yeah. And I think I learned that Kevin O'Leary, one of the guys from Shark Tank, working to buy TikTok, I think, as an answer to like,
well, trying to buy it.
They've had a lot of people that are willing to do it. The problem is they're not willing to actually sell. So unless something changes on that side, all the buyers in the world can come out, but you know, they're not willing to give up that algorithm, and they're not willing to sell the platform. I think they're going to, you know, wait for this date to come close. You're going to see some court challenges that might try to put it off, but yeah, I mean, there's, I've heard Kevin, I've heard, you know, a lot of the, you know, all the social media platforms, they would love to absorb it. They all want that algorithm, but you know, they won't sell.
Yeah.
Well, just look for the new app. Once TikTok shuts down, it'll be replaced by like, you know, Rick Rock or something like that.
Rick Roll.
And it'll be in, you know, all American colors. So
perfect.
That's it for the news this week. When you're writing a book, the first draft is the easy part. It's what comes after that hurts. The confusion, the self-doubt, questioning this, questioning that, trying to get feedback so you can feel confident making changes. It's a lot to handle. And that's why I'm delighted to say that this episode of the Writers Inc. podcast is sponsored by AutoCrit. One of the most value-packed memberships for any author, AutoCrit brings you an amazing suite of tools that can make it a breeze to plan, write, and edit your books all in one place. From start to finish, everything you need to produce a strong, confident story is at your fingertips. Get instant developmental feedback on plot, conflict, characters, themes, and more through the Story Analyzer. And edit each sentence to perfection with a complete interactive editing suite packed with reports and insights. And that's not to mention additional benefits like private community forums and live members-only support and writing sessions every single week. It's an incredible place to be for any writer. And listeners of the Writers Inc. podcast can take advantage of lifetime AutoCrit Pro membership for one single payment. That's right, no renewal fees. Head to AutoCrit.com/JD to get yourself a lifetime membership now. Big thanks to AutoCrit for sponsoring the show.
All right, JD, who is up this week?
This week we've got Peter James. He's the UK number one best-selling author of dozens of thrillers. His latest novel is called They Thought I Was Dead. It's the 20th book in his Roy Gray series, and it released, I believe, July 2nd. This guy's had 19 number one bestsellers, so you'll definitely want to pay attention to this one. Peter James.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, Dick. Hi. How are you?
Good, sir. Nice you speak with me. You've actually been involved in a lot of television film productions over the years, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I kind of started my career in writing a daily program for preschool children in Canada.
Right.
Called Polka Dot Door. And then I made a number of low-budget horror movies, classy titles like Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things,
corpse grinders. I did graduate, and I did the last movie I was responsible for. I ran the company that made Merchant of Venice with Al Pacino and Joseph Fiennes. But that was the point at which my writing was really starting to, my novel writing was starting to take off. And I found the problem in the movie business is that you're always part of a committee. You're arguing with other people who you don't necessarily think are on the same planet that you are.
Right.
Whereas with a book, you know, great thing is if I don't want to change a single word, I don't have to.
You're still arguing, but usually you're arguing with the characters a bit because they have an idea about what you want to do. You have an idea what you want to do.
Yeah, this is very true. My, you know, Roy Grace and Norman Podding and Glenn Branson keep telling me, no, I don't think we'll do that. I think we'll do it this way.
You know, it's so funny too when you try to describe that, because obviously we have a lot of authors that listen to the podcast. When you try to describe that feeling of the will of a character pressing upon you to do something, normies look at you like you're obviously not okay. Blink twice if you need help, you know? But that is, I mean, I don't know how it is for you. You've been doing this for some time, but that's one of the greatest feelings in the world when the character sort of takes over and starts leading you down a path. You still find that after all this time?
Oh, completely. I think that, you know, people always say to me, you know, are you a planner or, you know, are you a kind of just wing it? And I'm actually a mixture of both in that I always like to know the ending of my book. Because I liken that. I think, well, you wouldn't get in a car and start driving if you didn't know where you were going. Yeah, whether it's to the local supermarket or whether you're driving to Wellington or wherever you're heading for.
Right.
But I also think that the excitement in a book comes when something pops in my head that literally wasn't there 10 seconds ago. And I know that when those little nuggets happen, that I've got to follow that. Because it's going to keep gnawing at me until I do follow it, and I love that kind of spontaneity.
Where do you feel that comes from? Do you think that's your subconscious is bubbling bits and pieces away? It's borderline insanity. It's potentially a bit of supernatural, something coming in and taking over. Where do you have any idea?
I think it's your subconscious,
right?
I mean, I'd love to think there's supernatural. My late mother is up there who are guiding me. And she says, no, Peter, darling, don't do that. I think you should have Grace do this. But I think it comes out of combination, out of subconscious and out of a really well-made vodka martini with four olives.
Right. That's very helpful. Yeah, the old Hemingway.
Hemingway said, right drunk, get it sober.
That's right.
It does actually. I think that stimulus does help. You know, my best writing time is 6 till 8:30 in the evening, and I kind of fuel it with a stiff drink and music, and I get in the zone.
What kind of music do you listen to? Because I know this is a big debate with a lot of authors. I can't listen to anything for the most part that has words in it, so I listen to a lot of film soundtracks. What kind of music do you listen to?
I have a really eclectic soundtrack, and it's interesting you say that because I can listen to words, but only by some, like I can, Van Morrison, I'm good with.
Right.
I can listen to the Kinks, but I can't listen to the Beatles. The Beatles, I don't know whether the Beatles takes me back too much to the 60s and my youth, but Kinks is absolutely fine. And then a bit of modern jazz. I even, towards the end of a book, I switch from popular music into opera arias. I find they kind of really just lift me up to the heavens.
And also, I guess it's anything that you... I know that some people are more prescriptive when they put music into their writing schedule. Like if they're writing a particular scene that might be kind of action-oriented or whatever it might be, they might match music to that. I've never been that organized. It's it's just whatever comes up on the playlist.
No, I kind of... It's like... I've always written on the hoof as well. You know, I have no time for authors who say, I can only write when I'm in my garden shed. And I have to walk 3 times around my desk and then rearrange my pen. I think you're a writer, you write.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same with writer's block. You know, I mean, plumbers if you're a lawyer, you don't have lawyer's block or a taxi driver. I can't drive today. I'm blocked.
Right.
Yeah, maybe a plumber, you have plumber's block, but you know, that's a kind of different kind of block.
Right. Usually a hairball. Hopefully a hairball.
Yeah, that's hopefully.
You've had an amazing sort of moment in the past little while. There's obviously a lot of Roy Grace fans around the world, but you've got a rather royal fan of late. Can you tell me about that?
I have, yeah. Her Majesty Queen Camilla 2 weeks ago announced on her podcast that my detective Roy Grace is her favorite fictional detective. I was in tears.
That's great.
I just sat there and listened to it, and I thought, like, you know, I just wish my parents were still alive and they could have heard that. And my mother was a huge, both of them, they were big royalists, and I was just gobsmacked. I thought, you know, she could have named anybody, you know, Sherlock Holmes or Miss Marple, Poirot, any of the great detectives, living or dead, from living or dead authors. So I was just amazed. I've known that she was a fan for quite a long time, but about 8 years ago, like, a friend of mine rang me and he said, whatever you're doing, stop it, go out and buy a copy of the Daily Mail newspaper.
Right.
So I went out, and there on page three was a photograph of, she was then the Duchess of Cornwall, Camilla, sitting in her office, and there was a row of 8 Roy Grace novels on the shelf behind her. And she said that was one of her 2 favorite authors. And I wrote a letter to her saying, you know, thank you very much. And she wrote me a really nice, like, 2-page handwritten letter back. And then after that, I'd always send her the first edition of the latest book, and she'd always write me back a chatty letter.
Oh, wow.
In fact, there was one, she said, oh, thank you. I'm just off to Australia with my husband. So it'd be something to read on the train, on the plane. And then she wrote me again saying, well, I've got to Australia and I've now run out of your books. So what am I going to read? Be back.
Right. You take a year to write this thing, and folks read it in a day or two. So
I know. And then they go and post a review on Amazon that gives you 1 star because it arrived with the packaging broken.
I know. And you know, a part of the love that obviously folks have for Roy Grace and the novels is, at least how I feel, is his story, because he does have a bit of a unique story, you know, the detective that can't figure out his own puzzle, his own mystery, and that has been Sandy. And now this latest book you're writing, They Thought I Was Dead, is from, and we learned about Sandy from the very first Roy novel. This was this puzzle he couldn't fix, the disappearance of his first wife. And now we're hearing from her. We're hearing her story. Why now? Why did you decide 20 years on from that very first mention that this was the time to tell her story?
Well, it's funny. When I was first asked by my publishers back in 2002-03 if I'd be interested to create a new fictional detective,
right.
At that point, I'd been going out with the police for many years doing research for my earlier novels, which was psychological thrillers mostly. And I got to know a lot of detectives. And there was a kind of almost a cliche in crime fiction where you have the detective with a broken marriage and a drink problem. And the reality in England is that no cop with a drink problem would last 24 hours, just wouldn't. And I thought, you know, what detectives do is they solve puzzles. And it might be interesting to create a detective who had a personal puzzle of his own that he can't solve. Right. So when I created Roy Grace, he's just dead simple. He's coming up to his 39th birthday, and we learn that nine years earlier, he'd come home on his 30th birthday looking forward to a nice dinner out with Sandy and their 2 best friends, and she was gone.
Right.
And for 9 years, he doesn't know what's happened to her. He continues to function as an effective homicide detective, but all that time, spare time, he's looking for, did she take her own life? Did she have an accident? Did she get kidnapped? Did she run off with a lover? And my plan was to set the mystery up in dead simple and give the answer in the second book in the series, in Looking Good Dead.
Right.
And Dead Simple came out, and to my amazing good fortune, it became like an instant global bestseller. And I was inundated, to my surprise, with emails and letters from readers speculating what had happened to Sandy.
Right.
And I thought, hey, we could have some fun. And I think part of the fun of writing, and I think I'm sure you know this yourself, is that you can you can tease readers as long as ultimately you're fair and honest. So I started over the course of the next few books putting in little sightings of Sandy
right
here and there. And Roy Grace has been idolizing her. She was the most perfect wife. She made their home idyllic. And I start to show maybe Roy, she's not quite so perfect. You know, look, I'm showing readers things that he can't see. And I carried this on, and readers seemed to love it. But then after about book 11, 12, I started getting one or two almost snarky emails. The classic was a guy who said, "Dear Mr. James, I've just worked out that I'm a lot younger than you, and I imagine I'm much fitter than you, which means you're going to die before me. I hope you've left the secret of what happens to Roy Grace's missing wife safely in your publisher's vaults."
Wow.
And then about 3 years ago, I think I had I had loads of these, but it's a particularly touching one. "Dear Mr. James, I'm 89 years old, and the doctors say I don't have very long to go. Please tell me what happened to Sandy. I promise I'll take it to the grave with me."
Did you tell him?
And I thought, you know what I'd do? I thought, I'll write a 100-page novella revealing what happened to Sandy. And I started writing it, and just as we were saying a bit earlier, she, grabbed hold of me.
Yep.
And almost said to me, "No, you're not going to do me justice in 100. And I just became more fascinated with Sandy as I wrote, and it ended up as a, they thought I was dead, as a full-length novel.
Right. Now, was it a bit of a different feeling, too? Because this is a standalone novel, and you've got, you know, many Roy books. Was it a bit of a... I mean, obviously from a different point of view too, but how was the feeling very different in writing this book? Because it's a very different point of view. And also, you know, this is kind of a one and done, or at least that's what it seems to be.
Yes. It was different because I've written it in the first person, and, you know, I've written it from a female's perspective, which was challenging. I mean, luckily my wife Laura is very creative, and so we work quite collaboratively on it, and she'd say, "I don't think she'd think that. I think she might think that." So I had a real kind of steady hand on the tiller as I was writing. But I did enjoy when I'm writing Roy Grace, I'm a stickler for getting detail accurate of everything to do with policing. So I am not restricted, but I have to be really careful to get stuff accurate. With Sandy, I was able to much more free flow it. So I really enjoyed writing that book. I loved, and also showing people that maybe, you know, don't judge a character, you know, that, yeah, she's got her problems, but that they're not all of her own making.
I think I know the answer to this as you describe it. Were there surprises that were delivered to you? I'll put it that way, delivered to you as you wrote the novel, like, whoa, that's, I didn't know that about her as you're writing. That was kind of like a bit of a fun moment for you as you write the novel.
Absolutely. Yeah, there were a couple of big fun moments about her. And also, I did want to, or I think that one of the things that a lot of people don't realize, that if you're married, the partner of a police officer in particular, I mean, all emergency services are the same, they're doing shift work. But police officers, particularly if you're a homicide detective, that you are always, you as the partner of a homicide detective, are always going to come second place to a corpse.
Right. Right, which is a line you use in the book, right?
I think I do. Yeah. Did I? Yes, I did.
Yeah.
But it's true, because, you know, you and your other half might be going out to celebrate an anniversary. You get a phone call. There's someone's been found murdered. You know, is having your prawn cocktail and steak more important than trying to pacify the loved ones of somebody who's just been found dead?
I guess to some extent, it's like that with an author, as much as many of us put ourselves into our work, and you've done a lot of pretty in-depth research when it comes to the Roy Grace novels. Is there any moment or moments, all with all the research you've done and all the things you've done, what's one of the more strange things you've done to really understand a character, a moment, or a crime scene in preparation for a novel?
I've done a few. I think one of them, I'm claustrophobic. And when I wrote Dead Simple, the premise of Dead Simple is a stag night prank that goes wrong. And the groom, Michael Harrison, is left buried alive in a coffin in remote woodlands. His friends have done it to pay him back for all his pranks. And they're going to come back 2 hours' time, dig him up, and they all get killed in a car wreck.
Right.
By the way, there's a funny little postscript to that. When the book came out and I did a tour in New Zealand, and I was in a lovely bookshop in Hamilton. I think it's called Penny's. I can't remember the store's name. And I did a signing, and 3 days later, the lady who owns the bookstore emailed me, and she said, one of our customers bought the book, and she's just come back in, and she says she can't read on unless I can let her know if he does get out of the coffin.
That's fantastic.
I asked a firm of funeral directors that my then wife, my former wife, I did probate, so she knew a lot of funeral directors, and I said, could you put me in a coffin for half an hour, screw the lid down?
Wow.
And I was absolutely terrified. I think that was one of the dumbest things I've ever done.
Did it help with the writing process, or is that, you think it went too far?
It really did, because I managed to get that sense of real claustrophobia. I mean, I am claustrophobic. I don't like to sit in the back of a two-door car.
Right.
And I arrived at this, it was a family firm of funeral directors, and they were all gone out to collect bodies and attend funerals. And they'd left this elderly, I mean, very elderly, great grandpa in charge.
Yeah.
The guy was probably nudging 90. He said, oh, yes, you've come to be put in a coffin, haven't you? And I'm thinking, and he says, you really want to do this? I said, I do. So it hadn't occurred to me just how narrow a coffin is.
Right.
I thought it'd be more like lying on the floor of an elevator. Right. But, you know, you're actually hemmed in. And he says, you really want me to put the lid on and screw it down? I said, and I had checked with a coroner's office, with a coroner beforehand. And I said, how long do you have in a coffin of air? He said, well, in a well-made coffin, you've probably got 3 to 4 hours. But if you hyperventilate, you can knock that down at 40 minutes. Anyhow, he shuts the lid, and it's now pitch dark. And I can hear the screws turning. And then my first thought is, what if there's a spider in here? And then I'm thinking, what if he drops dead or goes across the road and gets run over? It was the worst 30 minutes of my life, but I think it really helped get the scenes realistic.
Right. That's fantastic.
That was definitely one of the kind of weirdest. But I get some fun things too for a new book I'm writing for next year. I actually got to drive a train.
Oh, wow.
I drove a train from Brighton to London and back. So that was a great perk.
Did you get there? You didn't take a wrong turn along the way, I guess.
No, I managed. And we got there on time and back. Good. And it was a passenger train. So, you know, kudos.
That's fantastic. You know, this is kind of off the cuff, sort of strange question. So of all the police research you've done for the novels, hypothetical, of course, but you think you could get away with a murder?
Yes. No, let me ask that question in two parts.
All right.
I know how to commit the perfect murder, right, but it's relatively easy to do it. What the hardest thing and what catches out most criminals is they can't live with their conscience having done it.
Oh, right.
You know, if you're a psychopath, then you can.
Sure.
You know, you kill someone, you can live with it, it's fine. But if you're a normal, hopefully decent person that I kind of delude myself that I might be, I think that if I were to murder somebody at some point, I'd have to take a mate out for a drink and say, hey, Rob, you know, I murdered Sandra, but it's okay because I love Wendy, isn't it? And he'll say, well, actually, Peter, it's not okay.
Right.
And now you've told me I'm an accessory to murder. So one of us is going to have to go to the police. That's how a lot of them get caught. They tell someone. And once you've told one person, you've told the world. Right. But the way to do it, there's lots of ways of doing it. A very simple one, inject insulin into somebody between their toes. The pathologist is never going to look there.
Oh, right. You've looked into this, right? Great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I asked the chief constable of Sussex a few years back, I said, do you think there is such a thing as a perfect murder? And he just, without batting an eyelid, he said, absolutely, Peter, it's the one we never hear about.
Oh, nice.
And he reckons that we have about 650 investigated murders in the UK. Police reckon there are at least another 650 they never hear of.
Wow.
I mean, the simplest thing, and the classic scenario is, Fred and Doris are married. Fred starts having an affair with Angela. He murders Doris. He puts her under the kitchen floor, re-screeds her, and he says, oh, Doris has gone off to live with her sister in New Zealand.
Right.
And a lot of people don't have wide friendship circles. A lot of people only have, a very narrow friendship. That's kind of one way. Another way, if you want to dispose of a body out at sea, is, well out at sea, chop it into bits.
Give to the sharks.
It's not coming back.
Right. No, that's great.
If you want any more tips, just call me afterwards.
Yeah, I was just thinking. It's funny too. There's always the joke about when you take a look at the Google history of an author that is pretty much matches in line with a serial killer. So you get a lawyer knocked on your door. As I mentioned, obviously this is a bit of a writer's podcast. So always love to hear sort of how you structure your day. Do you write every single day?
I write 6 days a week. Right. Once I started a novel, I write 6 days a week till I finished.
Now, is that prescribed time, 6 o'clock at night each night?
Yeah, I kind of, my writing day is slightly back to front, because when I worked in film and television and I was writing novels in between, I made my me time of like 6 till 8:30. It kind of worked with the time zones. I alternated between living in Toronto and Canada and Los Angeles and London. So I just thought, well, that's going to be my time. But the way that my day works is that we have a big menagerie of animals. I guess we'll start at 6 o'clock. So 6 o'clock, I mix myself a stiff drink, sit down, play music, and I'll write. And I try always to write a minimum of 1,000 words a day.
Right.
It roughly equates to a chapter for me. I write short chapters, generally short chapters. Finish about 8:30, have supper with my wife, and then we'll watch television or read, watch anything that's on Netflix or whatever, from Baby Reindeer to Succession or whatever.
Right.
Then in the morning, first thing, it takes about an hour. We go out early. We have 3 dogs, and we have about 70 hens. We have ducks, rabbits, pygmy goats. We walk the dogs and feed the entire menagerie. And then I usually go for a run, between anywhere from about 3 to about 5 miles in the weekdays.
Wow, that's great.
And the weekends longer, I do about 5 to 10 miles.
When you sit down to write, do you write straight through, or are you like some authors like to sit down and they'll edit a bit of the previous day's writing? I can't do that myself because I get too inside my own head. But do you do some editing along the way, or you get everything out down on paper?
Yeah, what I do is in the morning when I've come back from my run or whatever I've done, and I hunker down and I'll read what I wrote the night before.
Right.
And I both edit and usually expand it. So that 1,000 words from last night will become like 1,500 today, right, unless I made too big a drink. and then I carry on and I plan what I'm going to write that evening until about 1:30.
All right.
2:00. And then we have a light, very light lunch. And then in the afternoon, I do things like this. I do interviews or try and catch up with urgent emails, or I play tennis a bit. I plan to play tennis a couple of times a week, or go to the gym and just do weights and things.
Right.
Because I think writing is very sedentary. We sit for long periods. I try to counteract that by doing a lot of exercise and sport.
And a lot of ideas come in too, because exercising can be kind of meditative too. That sometimes you get some cool ideas from during that time.
Massively. I tend to, if I'm doing a long run, I'll listen to talking books quite often. Mm-hmm. But then I have to stop and turn the book off because an idea has popped for the book. Definitely. I find just my kind of, people say to me, do you get writer's block? And I was joking about it earlier, but the thing is that I don't get writer's block. What I do get, I get stuck, on a chat. I said, I always love that great Raymond Chandler line of, when I can't think what to write next, to have a guy come through the door with a gun in his hand.
Yeah.
But it's a terrific metaphor.
Right.
Because if I'm stuck, I'll go for a walk, get some fresh air, or go out for a run. And I'll start thinking about that metaphor. And I'll start thinking, right, you know, what, I'm not sure where to go with this chapter. What can I do that's going to actually really surprise my readers, but which I can then make sound credible?
Right. Now, I'm writing the fifth book in a series right now, and I had to laugh at myself. I've been doing it just long enough now to where I know that I'm a problem. But while I'm writing this book, as I'm writing it, I go, this is awful. This is, I don't know why I'm writing. No one's going to read this. And I realize I do that for every book, and I've written about a dozen books so far. You've written almost 40. Do you still have those moments when you're writing that first draft where you're like, I can't write, I'm not an author, I've been faking this the entire time? Do you still have those feelings?
Imposter syndrome, absolutely. Yep. I had a conversation a few years back in Bristol at a crime festival outside with Lee Child and Martina Cole. You know, they're pretty big authors.
Yeah.
And I was about page 70 on the new book I was writing. And I was really thinking it's crap.
Yep.
And I said to Lee and to Martina, I said, do you guys ever get to a point in the book where you think, this is crap, it's not going to happen? And Lee said, every book around, yeah, somewhere around between 70 and 100 pages. Martina Cole said exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And you just kind of have that confidence. You know you've done it. So just do it. I mean, starting out a new book, I think, oh, shite. Got this blank screen in front of me. Page one.
Right.
But to me, I guess one of the kind of big tips that I have for writers is that first chapter is the most important. The most important line, two lines you're going to write in the book are the first and last, because the first line will decide if anybody reads the second, and the last line will decide if anybody's going to read you again, because right, you've taken on that long journey, you know, and then you let them down with one bound he was free. So you've got to knock the first line is so important, and then the first paragraph, and by the end of the first page, your reader's got to be hooked.
Right.
And if you get that first chapter right, and I think books have feelings. You know, I can pick up a book. Most agents, every agent I've ever spoken to, and every publishing house editor says they can tell by the end of the first page if they like a book or not.
Right.
And I think it sets it up. If you get that first chapter right, and you get to the end of chapter one and you go, yes, that book's going to work.
Correct. Is there any sort of, as a bit of a parting gift to any writers listening? Some of them might have just be starting out. Some might have a couple under the belt. Is there any sort of thought you might have for them about how to push on and keep reaching for that success?
I'm actually writing a book on writing at the moment, which is one that's going to come out. I think that, I mean, the first thing is to remember that authors die. You know, it's not, you know, agents and publishers are always looking for the new big writers. It's not like it's a closed shop that you can never get in. I mean, it took me 20 years to trouble the bestseller list from the time I wrote my first novel. You know, I wrote my first book in my late teens. Luckily, it was never published. But I eventually got there in 1987 and got in that top 10. I think the best tip that I can give anybody, and I've done this myself throughout my career, is read. Don't be afraid to deconstruct other books. And, you know, if you want to write crime, take the kind of crime writer that you really admire, that you'd like to be, whether it's Michael Connelly or Ian Rankin, yourself, whoever, and literally deconstruct the book. Say, how did that person make me want to keep reading on? How did that author make me care for this character or hate that character? You know, if you were going to be a doctor, you know, at medical school, you'd have a cadaver and you'd spend a year deconstructing it. If you're going to be a car mechanic, you know, you'd take a car and the engine apart and put it back together, see how it works. And I think don't be afraid. You know, almost every author learns from their peers. You know, we're all learning all the time. And, you know, I remember the kind of books that were a big influence on me as a kid, like, you know, I always loved the Precinct novels from Ed McBain. And Home, I loved the sort of some of the Holmes material. I would take my favorite author, Alistair MacLean. I love, you know, there was lots of authors that I loved, and I would just read them and reread them and try to figure out how did they make that book work.
Okay, so what I thought was interesting was some of Peter's advice at the end there, that the first line is the most important line, the first chapter is the most important chapter, and the last line. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, first of all, this is one of the reasons the guy's got 19 number one bestsellers. You know, you could have the greatest story in the world, but if that first page sucks, you know, it's not going to sell. The people that pick it up at the store, the ones who look at it on Amazon, they're not going to get past it. So you got to rope them in with that first sentence. You know, my current favorite is The Martian. You know, like for those of you, I don't know if I want to actually say it, because I don't know if we're allowed to actually swear on here, but it opens up with I am so effed. You know, like I've never seen that in a book before, but you know, reading those couple of words, I was like, I'm in. I will read the rest of the story.
Yeah.
The last sentence too, I think, is important, you know, because you have those people who will flip to the end and read the last sentence. I've seen that these people exist. I don't understand it, but
you know, I don't remember last sentences. Do you remember last? Like, I remember first sentences, but last ones, I think, other than maybe the road, I remember him explaining something about musculature and a fish relating to human history. But I'm like, other than that, I don't think I really remember the endings of most books.
Yeah.
Or the last line. Like, I remember the ending in general, but not the very last line.
I think it's more about just leaving them with that final thought. Like, you want them to close that cover and remember that entire book. So it's got to either be something like an aha moment, or something that grabs them, or just something that just a final string or the final bow on the package. Because if you don't get them, like, you could have a really great book, you know, just like, you know, what I just mentioned at the opening, you could have the greatest book in the world. But if you don't end it properly, you know, like, that's the last thought they have before they leave a review for you, you know, before they think about what they're buying next. And, you know, you want to make sure they're, you know, fully in your camp when they close that cover.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why you want to end with something like, you know, the best review of this book could potentially win $1 million. That's your final sentence.
And then the aliens descended.
Or Southwest Airline points.
Southwest Airline.
Give me back my Southwest.
Yeah.
So have you ever had someone compliment your writing that you were just blown away by? Like the Queen?
Like
Her Majesty Camilla.
Oh, you mean like a fan?
Yeah.
You know, it's happened a couple of times. I mean, the first real big one was Patterson, you know, when he had read The Fourth Monkey and I had sent it to him for a blurb. So like that initial conversation where he told me everything he liked about the book, that was an extremely surreal experience. It's always nice. You know, it's funny though, because, you know, like, I think hearing compliments from my mom, you know, like, still weigh very heavily.
Yeah.
You know, like, my, aww, you know, I'm still waiting for like when my daughter can read that book. Like, those opinions, I think, mean more to me than any, you know, like a famous person or something like that.
I think that's awesome. My writing makes my mother cry. She's like, why?
Why do you do it?
What happened to you?
She did. She's the first time she ever read one of my stories. She said, whatever I did, I'm sorry.
I shared this on social media last week, but a reader reached out to say she had just read my current book, Forgotten Rune. And she said that she kind of went into a whole thing where she's been in the hospital. She had like a stroke, and it caused, you know, a lot of issues. She couldn't speak for a while. But when she got out, like, one of the things they recommended for therapy was to read, you know, and find your favorite authors and that sort of thing. And she's been a longtime reader of mine. So she read that book. And then because of that, she used that as a means of, you know, like that was something she and her husband could discuss. And, you know, it went for a while. So, I mean, she said some, I even pulled it up, but I'm not going to read any of it, but she said some really amazing things, you know, just thanking me for all of the books, thanking me for, you know, who I am as a writer and all that. So that one blew me away. I've had things kind of like that in the past, but that not one that was so specific in saying like your book helped me recover from a stroke or whatever. Most of the time it's the opposite, but your book nearly gave me a heart attack. Or
That's awesome. Do you listen to music while you're writing? We've talked about this, Kevin. I forgot. You're the chill hop.
I listen to a lot of chill hop. Although lately I'm listening to a lot of 90s music. That's my jam right now. I don't know why. Even with lyrics. I used to be real bad about, I couldn't. I always said I couldn't do that. And I remembered like back in the 90s when I was writing, that's all I listened to was, you know, whatever was on the radio. Heck, sometimes I would have movies or TV shows going while I wrote. So I did that because I was starting to get, I like the chill hop thing. I like, that's kind of jazz in its way. And the rhythms can kind of help you get into the right headspace. But all this other music, it was sort of like, I was starting to feel anxious listening to anything else. And I put this on and it just sort of put me back in a headspace of like, you know, the 1990s, which I consider some of my heyday. And it's had a huge benefit for me. So I'm going to just kind of experiment there.
Have you guys ever gone without, like, you know, I listen to a thunderstorm soundtrack when I write with noise canceling headphones. But today I had somebody in the house working on the, one of our air conditioners had died. So there was a tech running around our house and my wife wasn't home. So I had to like listen for him in case he needed something. So I couldn't wear the headphones and like, I had the hardest time getting anything done. Just cause I'm so used to that particular sound. Like, so have you ever gone without the music just to see what happens?
I go back and forth. Like sometimes everything annoys me, all sound annoys me. And then sometimes I need sounds and I don't exactly know why or what's going on. I just know like if I start to feel like irritated and itchy, like I'll either need to turn the music on or turn it off. And I'm not super picky about, I usually just like find something that I'm in the mood for and just let Spotify tell me what to listen to next, which works for a while. And then it just starts getting weird. And so you have to reset it. But for the most part, I just kind of listen to, I don't know. I go back and forth.
Yeah. It doesn't really matter that much to me. It depends. So my husband says like, I can work when a nuclear bomb is going off. And that probably is true. I'm a weird hyper-focuser, but he's the audiophile and he has like a record player and a billion vinyls. So it depends if he's playing something cool. Like if he's not cool, but like mellow. So if it's something quiet, like he's got on maybe some jazz or something, I'm fine. But what if he's blasting something like the Pixies, which I love, but I can't write to that, then I've got to put on like the white noise.
Yeah.
So because I got to drown that out. So it kind of depends. I usually can write through anything unless it is very energetic, high lyrics that I know. If it's lyrics I don't know, I don't care. Because then I'm not distracted. But if it's lyrics I do know, then I start, you know, singing along with the song instead of doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
During the pandemic, especially in 2020, when we couldn't go anywhere or whatever, like I started kind of having withdrawals. And I started playing ambient soundtracks from cafes and coffee shops. So you'd hear like people chattering and dishes clanking together and sometimes they'd have music and a lot of times they didn't, but I found that it was kind of comforting. I could just zone out and let that play. I didn't feel as anxious about things and, you know, felt more like, you know, a normal human being again. So I keep some of those around.
That's cool. Yeah. I like that during the pandemic, but speaking of being anxious, would you get nailed into a coffin?
Who's to say story? I haven't?
Hell no.
I'd try it.
You would. I hate confined spaces. I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but when I was a kid, my next door neighbor had horses, and they had a barn with these giant bales of hay in it, and it was like stacked two stories tall. We used to go in there. We would make like little like mazes like through the hay, so we'd like stack it up and make all kinds of forts and stuff. It collapsed one time while I was in there, and my friends wouldn't get a parent to help because nobody wanted to get in trouble. So I was stuck under this thing for like 6 hours while they tried to dig me out. So yeah, that scared the bejesus out of me. And like ever since then, like any kind of confined space has been a problem. And I know it started there because I still vividly remember it.
Yeah.
But like even when he was just talking about that, like the idea, like I don't even know if I want to be in a coffin when I'm dead. I do not want to be. Don't put me in a box. I'm going to need something a little bigger.
Are you going to be a tree? You're going to get planted?
Maybe that. Yeah, you can scatter me in the ocean or something.
I was thinking about that, doing the tree thing.
I told my family I'm turning everyone into diamonds, you know, there so you that go. That way.
Perfect.
Oh, I love your earrings. Thanks. It's my parents.
I want to be molded into that. Like an action figure. So, you know, take my ashes, mold me into like Spider-Man. So that for once I can actually be Spider-Man. So.
All right.
They'll probably goof and make a Gumby.
Oh no, God. We'll get that. When I was a kid, we actually, we moved when I was 12, but before that we lived in a small town and my dad knew someone at the local funeral home. So every Halloween he would get a coffin and bring it to our house. And we were that,
that's amazing.
That family on the block, there was like dry ice coming out of the garage and he would wear this horrifying mask and come out of a coffin. So I have coffin experience. Yeah, I got in it a couple of times, but you know, it was never nailed shut. Yeah. So there was none of that claustrophobia.
Yeah.
Let's talk about being stuck. So Chandler, a man comes to the door with a gun. I do love that. I think about that a lot. What do you do to get unstuck when you're stuck?
I mean, I just keep working because I learned a long time ago, if you get up while you're stuck, you will not get unstuck for, you know, until you sit back down in front of that computer, or at least for me. So that will prolong it over a weekend or whatever. So if I feel like I'm at some point where I'm stuck, I will stay there. I still, to this day, I tried to end like in the middle of a sentence. Like I always know what's coming next before I get up out of my chair. And that just makes it that much easier to keep going when I get back to it.
I tend to use looping. So if I'm stuck, I will loop back to some place earlier in the manuscript and reread and rewrite until I get back to where I was. And then I usually have the momentum to keep going. And if it's extreme, I'll go all the way back to the beginning of the book and do that because it means that I didn't lay enough groundwork somewhere. And so I'm stuck because I didn't set something up or whatever. And knowing where I'm stuck as I'm reading and rewriting, I realize, okay, if I tweak this, if I add that, if I take that out, then once I get to that point, I'm going to be aces. So that's what I had to do with this current book, by the way. I just got back to where after like a week, I finally got back to where I was stuck. And now I'm going in an entirely different direction too. So that's a very useful thing. Cause like, now I've got a different story than I had when I started.
Yeah. That sounds kind of like what Peter does, right? He does the 1,000 words and then the next day loops back, expands, and then keeps going. So yeah.
Yeah. That's my process too.
Yeah.
I think when I'm stuck, I'm learning that it's cause I don't know where I'm going. So, usually looking at that has helped me get unstuck, like looking at the end of the outline and figuring out, because it usually means I haven't thought of something. And so I've written myself into I don't know what happens next. And when I fix that, then it unsticks me.
Yeah. Yeah. I will just keep running into the wall over and over again until I either make progress or I get so frustrated, I go exercise, which I know Peter talked about too. And lots of times I find, you know, I don't stop working unless I'm in a rage, but you know, as a 40 something woman, I have lots of rage. So yeah, I would call it a run, but it's not a run. It's a jog at best. Or, you know, if I just take a shower or something, I'm like, oh yeah, then it just comes. I don't know if that happens. Yeah.
I have done that. Yeah, yeah. I have done that where especially showers. You know, I'll take walks and things like that, and that does kind of jar things loose. But I've probably come up with more plot points in the shower than anywhere else. And in fact, it's kind of a running joke now with my wife, because she tends to be in the bedroom because there's a TV in there in like the late afternoon. So when I get stuck, if I come in, she knows that I'm having an issue with the book. So
Kevin's having a shitty writing month and your water bill is through the roof.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm working on a particular outline for somebody right now, and I've got a really high water bill.
Do you need to exercise to counterbalance the sedentary writing life?
I realize I should.
Right. I was gonna say, I don't know if I have to. I know that I need to.
See, this is where being an Aspie actually helps, because if I don't exercise, like I will nag myself until I do. Like it will just completely eat at me. Like yesterday, like my normal routine is I go for it's about 4 or 5 miles, like walk, run. I kind of run half of it, walk half of it. Then I come home and I've got different routines that I do in our gym. And like yesterday was arm day, and my wife texted me about halfway through and she wanted to go out to dinner. And I'm like mentally doing the time, trying to figure out whether I can get the whole workout in before. And I had to do it. Like I wouldn't be able to go to dinner without finishing the workout, because I'd be at dinner the whole time thinking I still have to finish my workout. it's a horrible thing, but at the same time, it keeps me in shape. So I guess it's a catch 22.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have some like dumbbells that when I need to take a break from the writing, I usually will put on like some YouTube video or something. So what I'll do is while that video is playing, I'll do, you know, X number of reps. I think typically like I'll do like 30 reps per side or whatever, just to, you know, so that I'm not just lazy and getting fatter the whole time I'm in the office. But then I feel guilty and anxious because I'm not writing. And so I'm just, stress hormones are just keeping all the fat on me.
I'm going to get you a walking treadmill for Christmas.
Oh man.
For under your desk.
There. I've heard that's a bad idea. Like I've heard that can cause health problems, but maybe I'm only hearing that from people who don't want to do it.
So I haven't heard that they cause health problems, but
yeah, I've got one somewhere, but I don't use it. I have a stand up desk and I barely use it, but
yeah, that's all I need in my life is one more piece of equipment in my office that I don't use.
I'll mail you mine, Kevin. You can have it. So with that, JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Catherine Wood coming on. She's a graduate of University of Southern California, and she's going to be here to tell us about a recently released debut novel. It's called Lady Killer, described as White Lotus meets the talented Mr. Ripley. Catherine Wood.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.